Pam Carunchio, Energy Coordinating Agency, Philadelphia.
Thank you, Pam.
Now, what we usually, of course, start out with the latest from Washington and the RFP. And
can you speak a little louder?
Okay, I'll try to speak louder. Is that any better?
That's better.
A little bit better. Hello. Any news that you've heard from Joe or from Washington?
Actually, no. I haven't even talked to headquarters in a couple of weeks, and well, since our last PLC. So I'm assuming that they are still hoping by the end of the month, but projecting more toward the beginning of February. That's the last I heard, and I haven't heard anything different.
Mm-hmm. We assume that the RFP is in its final state, but it has to go through quite a few review processes, and then they release it, and Joe has no control. The people that we work with in Washington that are project officers don't have control over the release date. It's usually an administrative office, and all of a sudden it just comes out, and we will send everyone a notice and probably a copy of the RFP in there. Everyone that's on the PLC will get a copy of it. One of the things we're going to talk about today, I thought would be good to talk about allowable costs and some administrative issues before the RFP comes out. Someone just joined.
Hi, this is Odanis Hernandez from the Merrimack Valley Workforce Investment Board.
Okay. Good. Thank you for your insights last time on the workings of the WIB. WIBs are really important in these programs. One of the things we'll be talking about today, we're going to talk about some administrative issues, allowable costs, which we haven't really talked about, and disallowable costs, and a little bit about difference between subcontractors and partners and consultants. Before I do that, though, I just want to, of course, we always announce three things before this RFP comes out. The most important, again, is reminding you to get a hold of your regional job training coordinator, and their contact information are in the notes that we'll send out to everyone. Someone just joined?
Clem.
Okay. And where are you from?
Houston.
Okay. And
did you say Houston?
Houston, Texas.
Oh.
We got another Houston on the line, but he's from Nebraska. Now, you're from Nebraska. You're from Houston, Texas, right?
Yes, sir.
Great. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Someone else? Okay. We always remind people before the RFP comes out to contact your regional coordinator, and we always put those in the post-session notes. And if for some reason you're not on that list, just email me, msenew@aol.com, and just say, make sure I'm on the list. If you've got an announcement to this PLC, the Professional Learning Community, you're on our list, and so you'll be getting these announcements. When the RFP comes out, we will send a copy of the PDF to everyone. We're expecting in the next couple weeks. It's not unusual that it is delayed. It was supposed to be out before Christmas, but it's not surprising at all. It's very typical that it is delayed as much as a month or two. But the cycle will, even though it comes out late, they're going to have the 90-day process to submit it, and then these will be awarded, probably it'll be due in the spring, and then these will be awarded probably in August. And generally, they like to have it set before the end of the fiscal year, of course. They want to have the funds allocated, and then that allows you to start your first training cycle for spring so that they graduate in spring of 2014. So someone just joined? So during this period that before, as soon as the RFP comes out, you're not really able to talk personally about your specific grant with the regional coordinator. So that's why we again remind everyone, contact your regional coordinator. Even if you don't end up submitting, just let them know you're thinking about it. There might be some hints they can give you. They might be able to put you in touch with some people. They're basically on your side. They will not have any influence in evaluating your grants. Anyone that's in your region, your regional coordinator that you fall under, has to recuse himself from your evaluation. So there will be other people evaluating. They may ask them if they contacted them in advance. But just let them know that you're thinking of applying. You also want to find out who in your community or neighborhood may have a grant or had a grant, and you could find that out easy enough just by going to the EPA Brownfield site. I'll put the link to that, and it shows you on that site who has gotten a grant in your state, in your community, in your city, not only the current grantees, but those that went back from the beginning, the very beginning of the grants. So it's good to find out who's got a current grant, who had a grant. If someone in the past had a grant, you may want to contact them. It's really important if someone currently has a grant, because there are certain things that can torpedo your application, and that's having a duplicate program in the same community. So you really want to touch base with the regional coordinator. You want to see if there's someone else doing what you're doing, and of course you want to see what kind of competition you might have in other programs. You're also going to want to see, and you could find out at the same site at EPA, which we'll put in the notes, if there are any what they call RLFs. Those are revolving loan funds for cleanup, whether there are any brownfields assessment grants, whether there's any brownfield planning grants, or if there's any brownfields underground storage tank grants. And these are other types of grants. They're about the same size as the training grant, and they're given out each year. And, of course, the RFPs were due for the assessment and RLF grants just this last November. So there's a good likelihood there's someone in your community that may have submitted one of these grants, and you're going to want to also touch base with them, because when you submit your grant, you're going to want to make sure that you've included in that the coordinating with any grantees in your community that may be doing this. Now the ones that already have grants are easy to find at the EPA site. It's a little more difficult, the ones that may be submitting, but if you go to your local mayor's office, and usually the Office of Economic Development, and ask them, tell them what you're interested in doing, and find out if anyone has submitted any type of brownfield grant, they could lead you to the people that will be doing that. And it's not so much that these people are going to give you money or do anything. They may be positive to your program because they can become part of your program and they could be mentors and lead you on to potential employers. So there's a lot of reasons for that, but it's good to coordinate and know who they are going to their meetings. In fact, a very smart strategy, if you're submitting a grant or thinking of it, ask them if they're going to have any public hearings, and ask them that you would like to announce that you're thinking of submitting a grant application to the US EPA for a job training grant, and have that documented somehow so that you could put it in your grant proposal. There's a section in the grant proposal about community involvement, and if you can put into that section of the grant proposal, and most people don't think of this because it's too late, but they don't have enough time to schedule one of these announcements. If you could demonstrate that you've announced to the community and you've been working with a job training program, you're going to have a job training program, it will propel you, give you many kudo points in terms of working with the community, because you would be one of those people that not a lot of people do this, and you would be one that would have been working with the community made an announcement in a public meeting or in a city council meeting that you indeed intend to
This is Pittsburgh.
Grant. Yes, sir. Good. And where are you? And you're from where?
A. Philip Randolph Institute.
Great. Okay. Today we're talking about, the RFP is not out yet, but we're talking about some things that are important to do before the RFP comes out and as it comes out. And one of the, I also wanted to mention before we get into that, the two other things that are coming up. And we always mention two meetings. There are workshops that will be occurring. One is in April and one is in May. In April, there is a Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference in Washington, D.C. And I'll put links, I always put links to that site. I like to plug that. It's a, it's about good jobs, green jobs. It's all about not only brownfields, but also energy jobs and all kinds of green jobs. And we will be attending that. I'm not sure if we'll be having a session there yet, but we will be there. And the other one is the, and most important is the May 15th National Brownfields Conference, which will be held in Atlanta. And we suggest everyone register, and we'll have a booth and a session there about developing and sustaining a job training program. And that's really a good conference because all of the stakeholders, the insurance companies, the techies, all the cleanup people, it's a great place to make contacts, to find potential employers, and a lot of the grantees, the trainers, and people who are thinking of submitting grants go to that conference. So that's a good one if you need to get approval for it. It's a good thing to submit now. And I would, the closest hotel is the Omni. It's right at the convention center. And it's good to get your reservations in early. You could always cancel them if you need to. There's a small fee this year for covering the cost of the conference. Usually it's free, but it's not a lot, $50 or $100. So you might go to the Brownfield site, which I'll also put in the notes. But those are the two main things that are coming up at this point in time. One of the things I wanted to talk about today were these general things that you may want to consider before you submit the grant. And we already talked about the most important is contacting the regional coordinator. But I wanted to talk a little bit about allowable costs and what you can charge to this grant that EPA gives you and what you can't. And the reason I wanted to talk about that, and we usually don't talk about it too much, but it has a big influence on who your partners may be or who you may want to get as partners. And when the Brownfields job training program was set up, and it is involved and now called the Environmental Job Development, Workforce Development and Job Training Program, it's been broadened beyond Brownfields. It's now environmental. But when this first started, it was funded, it's been funded by CERCLA, and the legislation was set up, and the administrative rules was that you could not have administrative costs charged to this grant. So what this meant was organizations that were applying for this money could not charge off indirect costs, overhead costs. Often universities charge as much as 70, 80, 100% of their actual costs or administrative costs to cover the cost of operating the university. There's a good and bad part of this. It took a lot of the universities out of this program because they weren't able to charge off administrative costs. No one was really happy about it, but it was not something that we had a choice to vote on. It was a condition that if they were going to fund this program, they did not want people charging off overhead. So they said no administrative costs are allowed. So this is major because if you're a community college or you are a nonprofit group, you're not going to be able to charge off your overhead. So that is one of the big things you have to consider as far as this grant goes. The other thing is, they basically really restricted it to environmental training and not everything. And often when you get a grant from federal government, you could charge off a multiple number of things, not only administrative costs, but a whole lot of other things, life skills and advertising of different sorts. This program is fairly restrictive that way. A good rule of thumb is that you could charge to the funding that the EPA gives you anything that has to do with environmental training, and that's a good rule of thumb to use. And when we start getting down to interpretive questions, every year when we have our annual conference, people come up with all kinds of very specific questions, and there are some areas that are grayscale, but for the most part, it's pretty straightforward. For example, certainly it's okay to do curriculum development or curriculum improvement. You can do anything to do with the training. You can charge recruitment, screening, and placement costs to this grant. Things like health exams for your students, because they need to do that to do the training. If they're going to put a respirator on, they may need a health exam to before they put on a respirator. You can even charge the rent for a training facility. That's pretty much towards the edge of it. You could not charge overhead costs for a facility, but training rent for a training facility you could. You can't give people stipends, but you could give them travel money to get to training. So you can transportation to and from. If some grantees actually make a deal with the local bus companies to give them special cards, but you can arrange or help subsidize them getting to and from the training. So again, if it has direct implications to training, you're okay. The things you can't do, and the most notable, is life skills. Life skills is incredibly important, and you have to do it here with these programs, but you can't charge it to the EPA grant. So life skills is one of those areas where it's very important for you to find a partner who can provide life skills training and not charge you to this grant. We mentioned administrative costs, which you can't charge to the grant. You can't charge things like fundraising costs. Now, here's where it gets a little mushy. You can, if you go out and trying to develop partners and mentors, people who are going to work with you in the training program, and people who are going to come to your open house and your get acquainted nights, those would be allowable costs because they have to do with placement and recruitment. But you could not charge if you were just going to go out and have a fundraiser to get money for it. Now, you could go and charge off if you were going to get partners to work on the training. That would be allowable. It has to do with the training. So there are some gray areas, and one of the things we encourage people is to check with their coordinator if they have a question about it. What I would say is did someone want to say something?
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Say, for instance, I got a company here that's certified in several different of these areas that I'm going to train my folks in, say air pollution and underground storage. But they in business, so, and they want to do business with us. Am I able to charge or am I able to pay companies like that to do our training?
Excellent question, and I also want to talk about that. There's three types of entities. You could have partners, you could have sub-grantees, and you could have contractor consultants, okay? And yours falls into that last category, contractor consultants. Now, here's the difference between them. A sub-grantee is someone who is written in your grant, but they're a sub-grantee. They're not a contractor. They're nonprofit organizations like a community college, they have to fall into all of the regulations that you fall into under a grant. In other words, if you're audited, they fall into that audited grant. They're going to look at them just like they are you if you are the fiscal grantee. So if you're going with a community college or if you're going with a community group that's a nonprofit, they may be a subgrantee. The other person, the other thing that many grantees use are either subcontractors or consultants, and this is addressing Houston's question. Yes, you can do this, but there's a couple of conditions. You really need to go out, and a good time maybe now, actually, you need to go out and get some bids. You could go on, whether it's Craigslist or eBay, or you don't have to have a real formal RFP, but you need to have a request for proposals and put some sort of a public request for proposals to develop and provide training and explain your program. Now you could get these proposals before you submit the grant. You could say you're soliciting proposals for training, and this would be the program, and it would be over 2 years, and this is what you'd be teaching, and then have that company respond to that, and hopefully you'll get a couple of other people who may respond, local consultants, and keep those records in a folder so you'll have them, and then you can use them as a contractor. Now, you do not have to go to the lowest bid. You do not have to, you could choose anyone you want. You need to choose the person that can best do the job. What you have to stay away from, Houston, is a quid pro quo type of situation that is, and I've seen this done a lot in the old days, where a contractor will actually write the grant, and with the understanding that they're going to be the one that will perform the work. You really have to stay away from that. You can't do that. They can help you write the grant, but then when you get the grant, you're going to have to competitively bid now and go out for RFPs. Now, when we say competitively bid, doesn't mean that you're going to go out for three bids and you're going to take the lowest price. When you get your RFPs back, you say, we decided to go with XYZ company because they're local, or because they have better experience in underground storage tanks, and we're going to be teaching that. And so you're going to have in your folder this documentation. And what we want to do is, to the people that are on this PLC, we want to make you audit-proof. And the way to be audit-proof is from the very beginning to set up these standards and get things together so that you're not charging disallowed costs, so that you've got partners who are providing the services that you're not allowed to provide, charge to the grant. And here is a perfect case where you've got a great contractor, and it sounds like you really want to use them, but I would just, as a formality, have them send you something that they have these capabilities and they would like to do that, and try to get a couple of other bids. You might go to a local community college or send to them. Do they do training? And start a folder and have it in that folder. Once they're on board, then you're good to go, and they can help you. But if you're ever audited, and if someone really wanted to say, okay, we're gonna look at this program with a fine-tooth comb, they might say, okay, you've got XYZ, a contractor doing all this. They're a private sector company. Did you get bids? And you could say, yes, I did. Pull out that folder that you did 2 years earlier or a year earlier and say, here's what I did. And they're good to go. So.
Okay. And then this other question is, like, say, for instance, when I was, I got like 250-something members. So we wanted to do what we call a 40-hour Hazwhopper. Okay, the company we selected, he was charging like something like $4,000 for 15 people at a time. So is that wrong, or should I ask them, over a period of 2 years, I'm trying to run 150 people through the program. Could you give me one set price, or is it that I can bill him, you know, from class to, or he could bill me, like, from class to class?
Yeah, he can do it. He can bill you class to class, and just, I would, for your own sake, and he's on board already, but I would have him, just have him submit a proposal and get a couple other proposals if you can.
Okay.
So you could demonstrate that you this was a competitive bid. And now, when you, for those who may not be using a consultant or a training company like Houston is, you could go to what we call a sub-grant, but that's got advantages and disadvantages. The sub-grantee is now obligated to act just like you are. So they have to follow all of the same rules that you follow, where on a contractor, they can charge you whatever they want. They don't have this indirect cost business or disallow. They're going to charge you what they're going to charge you for that work, and that's acceptable. So nobody's going to audit them or look at their costs or anything like that. They're just going to look at you and say, was this bid out competitively? It's just like when we go out for hotels or have a meeting, we'll get three bids, and you can just get three bids, and then you don't have to, there's nothing that says you have to pick the lowest, nothing at all. So
as long as you can justify it.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right. And so you know, that $4,000, that really is not a bad price. If you divide that by 15 people, that is only $266 each, which is way under the average cost of a 40-hour HAZWOPER if you were just to go take it somewhere.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, because I do got a couple of companies, you know, that this time I'm looking at both of them, because one does my underground storage and the other one don't. But one that don't do the underground storage, he do like the HAZWOPER and the other stuff that the other one don't. So what I'm hearing here is, if I get my classes 15 at a time, then I could just go ahead and call him up and he teach him, and he could bill me, and the other guy I could get another class with the other company as well then, huh? So, I mean, I'm not just set on no one person. Can I, even when I get the grant, can I still shop around and get the best price, or do I have to just use whoever that I mentioned?
I think as long as you get those competitive bids, you can use a different trainer for each class. Is that right, Mike?
That is correct. As long as you have those three bids in your folder, you could use anyone you want anytime you want. So,
okay.
In fact, I could put in the notes, I get some stuff from a national trainer. You could always use them as one of your quotes. There's a bunch of national trainers out there that you could just email to and say, you know, we're thinking of these classes. Can you perform these classes? And have them say yes. And this, I get a rate sheet, what they charge for each class. And I know HAZWOPER is over $600, $700 on this place. So
yep.
That would qualify as a bid. So
okay.
You can get, so anyone thinking of using consultants and contractors, which almost everyone does, just to have in your pocket those competitive bids and put the date on them. Once you've had that competitive bid, you don't have to do it all the time. You just, once you bring someone on board, you're good to go. In fact, people, who, if you've used them in the past and can demonstrate that you had done competitive bids in the past, that's good to go. They just want to make sure that there was some sort of a competitive bidding going on.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So what I would suggest to anyone is go out, get a bunch of, couple of training bids, and then sit down with these things, put them in a folder, put the date that you did it, what you did, maybe where you put the announcement or how you did it, if you called them up or emailed them or contacted by phone and asked them to submit something, and what they do and what the cost would be, and have that all in that folder. And then from then on, you can go and contract as you need to, and you're good to go. And you're also audit proof. So that's a good way to do it. If you go with a subgrantee, you don't have to do any of that, except that subgrantee is now subject to all the audit provisions and all of the provisions you are. For example, they will not be able to charge indirect costs. They can't do any of the things that you can't do. They become basically you, and that's got advantages and disadvantages as we talk about that. You can have a partner. Now, a partner may have no financial interest at all, and you could have as many partners as you want, leverage partners. You could have, in fact, you're going to need leverage partners. You might have someone who's donating equipment. You may have a Department of Labor or a WIB that's partnering with you. They don't really have to undergo anything like that. They're actually putting their resources and money next to yours, and so you don't need to subject them to those conditions. In other words, if you have a WIB and they're providing you with life skills training and some placement services, you don't have to bid for that, or you don't have to go out and get three bids, or you don't have to subject them to a subgrantee unless you're giving them money. But if you're basically putting your programs next to each other and you're helping each other in a leverage situation, you don't have to worry about that. And if in the case of an audit, for example, they might say, well, how are you providing your life skills? And you might say, well, we're using the local workforce investment board. Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. They're not going to audit the workforce investment board or anything like that. They're just providing your life skills. They just want to make sure that you're not spending the EPA money on providing life skills. So you're good to go there. And we would encourage, and it's very important in your grant application, that you get as many of those partners as you can, providing those ancillary services that you can't provide. Whether it's in terms of placement services, you can use that under the grant. But it mostly has to do with, if you're going to give someone stipends that are not travel to and from training, that could be provided by someone else. Administrative, if someone else wants to provide food and refreshments, you can't do that under this grant. But if you wanted to have a meal, you might get a company to donate those things. They won't ever be audited. They're not subject to an audit. You don't have to bid for that. They're just going to give you these leveraged items, and EPA wants you to leverage as much as you can. So if you could go to one of your local employers and say, well, we would like someone to, we're looking for someone who could sponsor a good acquainted one, get acquainted night or something. Would you be interested in working with us? And they, sure, we could. We'll foot the bill for, you know, for an open bar, or we'll foot the bill for some sort of refreshments. So that would be fine. Anything that you can't do under the grant, you would try to find partners to do that. And of course, as I said, those are encouraged.
Excuse me. So you said, like, for instance, a year ago, we did what you call lead safe supervisors. So the city of Omaha, they end up hiring about 7 of our folks to scrape and paint lead houses during the spring and summer. And so now this year, they certificate is running out. So you said we can throw refresher courses as well.
Yes.
Or do we have to take?
Well, we're really, you can't do refresher courses by themselves. Well, you could do refresher courses for your grantees who have gone through the course before. In other words, you're basically, unless these people are unemployed, if you said you were going to do that, you would probably get demerits. In other words, the main focus of the grant that they're funding are people who don't have jobs that you're going to be training to get jobs. Now,
they pretty much going to be laid off again without that certificate anymore. And like I said, the people I deal with are mostly just my members, you know. So we've trained them. They got work. Then they the certificates run out. They back unemployed. And we got, and a lot of them aren't computer literate and stuff like that. So you're saying that we can still provide some type of life skill training?
Well, you can't provide
to get them prepped for a job.
You couldn't provide it with the EPA money. It doesn't mean you wouldn't include it in your program. Remember, the main thrust of the EPA funding is for unemployed people without skills, to give them skills so they could get jobs. Now, anything above and beyond that, you can do it, but not with the EPA money. And you could make it part of your program, but you just can't fund it with the EPA funding money.
Oh, okay.
So now, if you if you had someone that had some experience in the past and they were unemployed and you were just, you recruited them to go through this program to get a job, you know, you wouldn't focus your program or write your grant that this is what you're doing. But if for example, if there were people out there that applied to go through your program, they were unemployed, and they wanted to go through your program to get skills, to get jobs, you could bring them into your program as being the best candidates for it. But you really can't focus the program on giving refresher courses to people who already have the skills to get employed.
I see. It's just like what we do. We take the incumbent workers, somebody who really never been employed, who like dropped out of school, who really don't have an idea of what they want to do. Those are the other half of the people in the organization. So what we do is we lay out this training program, and then we see, you know, like say for instance, OSHA, lead, embankment workers, stormwater management, underground storage tank. Then we send them through these series of courses, and then then after that, they obtain these certificates. Then we also have what you got, a lot of contractors that really come here looking for skilled laborers. So, okay, yeah, I won't worry about the folks who already did work and have certificates. We'll just focus on my incumbent workers, folks who ain't never really had any type of job experience or anything.
Absolutely. And if you have any questions on these allowable or disallowable costs, you could send me an email, and if we can't answer it, we'll pass them on to EPA, or you could contact your regional coordinator, and they'll be able to talk to you about allowed and disallowed costs. Even after the RFP comes out, you could ask them, is this an allowable cost or not? And you want to make sure that when you do write your grant, you don't want to put in that you're going to fund some disallowed costs with EPA money, because that'll blow your grant out of the water. So you want to be careful on what's funded by EPA and what's funded by leveraged funding. So, well, we could talk about this again more next time, or if you have any questions, you could put an email. We'll try to put some of these. We'll put these web sources in the notes, so you could go to EPA and see who in your area might be doing this now. And our next PLC will be on February 6th. So there's a really good possibility that the RFP will be out by then, but we'll see. So anyone have anything they want to add before we adjourn for today?
This is Colleen Kokas from New Jersey DEP.
Yes.
Early in the call, you had mentioned about sort of tapping into finding out what brownfield applications, grant applications, were made to EPA this year. Just so people know, the state regulatory authority has to provide letters of support for every application, every brownfield grant application that's submitted to EPA. So another sort of course could be to reach out to the regulatory agency, and there is a brownfield coordinator for each state, and that resource guide is on EPA's brownfield website. So you could reach out to them and ask them for whom and what projects did you provide letters of support this year for those brownfield grants.
Okay. Excellent, excellent. So I'll put the link to the brownfield, the general.
I could send you the link to that document because it might be a little hard to locate. There's a lot of information on there.
That'd be great. And what they need to do is get to the state's brownfield coordinator.
Right.
And they could find that contact information in the link that you're going to send me.
Correct.
That would be awesome. And that would be a great way to find out who is actually active in your state, and you need to contact them. Even if you have a grant now, a lot of the grantees have never done that, and that's a great suggestion. You can get a list of who's there, and that will lead you also to contractors. So it's a great resource.
Right, or potential projects in your area,
right.
You know, that might
thank
be
you.
Privately funded.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you. Very helpful. Well, thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you on the 6th of February. We'll send some post-session notes out next day or two with any of these links. And if you have any questions, just email msenew@aol.com. Okay, well, thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you
very much.
Bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.